And so Perry writes as a mother who wants her black boys to survive, and she wants to think about what it means for black maternal life to be structured by an anxiety, an intense worry about a world that seems governed by a desire to kill black people, to ensure that life is not livable for black people.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the next hour. The voice you just heard is Jennifer C. Nash, who is speaking about a black mother who published a letter to her black sons to prepare them for life in a society that disregards their right even to survival. But now the letter is there for everyone to read. Nash goes on to say that, quote, if in our country people cannot hear black pain, and particularly black maternal pain, perhaps what we need to do is make them feel us, end quote. Today on The Old Mole, C.S. Song speaks with Jennifer Nash about her book, How We Write Now, Living with Black Feminist Theory. Nash talks in particular about black mothers' use of the epistolary form to convey their anguish to a broader public. Jennifer C. Nash is professor of gender, sexuality, and feminist studies at Duke University. This segment originally aired on Against the Grain on October 16, 2024. Against the Grain is a weekly radio show hosted and produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song on KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California. It's a program of ideas, in-depth analysis, and commentary on political, economic, social, and cultural issues important to radical thinking and activism. Before we get rolling, I want to remind you that KBOO is volunteer-powered, non-commercial community radio that gives voice to every corner of our diverse community. If you can, please support KBOO. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, texting KBOO to 44321, or by mailing a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. KBOO thanks you. Now, here is C.S. Song from Against the Grain with his guest, Jennifer C. Nash.
Today on Against the Grain, black parents worry about racism's impact on their children. How is this anxiety, this anticipation of harm, rendered knowable to non-blacks? I'm C.S. Jennifer Nash discusses her book, How We Write Now, Living with Black Feminist Theory, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What's it like to worry about the future of your black child in an anti-black world? What does a black parent anticipate in the sense of how their offspring may be mistreated, injured, even killed? And what happens when parents convey their concerns, their fears, and their advice to their black children? Some of what non-blacks know about some of these things comes from letters written by parents to their children that are published as essays or books. Jennifer Nash is interested both in the nature of racialized worry and anxiety and the way they are made knowable to, made feelable by, non-black audiences. Jennifer Nash is the Jean Fox Obar Professor of Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies at Duke University. Her new book is How We Write Now, Living with Black Feminist Theory. When Jennifer Nash and I connected recently, I mentioned a letter written by Sabrina Fulton that was published in Time magazine in August 2014. Who, I asked, is Fulton, and who was her letter directed to?
Sabrina Fulton is Trayvon Martin's mother, and she's, I think, continues to live on in the national imaginary as a Black mother who we come to know through her attachment to loss. Her son was murdered by George Zimmerman, who was then acquitted, and in some ways his murder started the movement for Black life, or one chapter in the movement for Black life. In the chapter on letters, I talk about a letter that she publishes in Time magazine to Michael Brown's mom. And one of the things that both Fulton and Michael Brown's mom have talked about is how the loss, the murder of their sons, has given them entry into a mother's club that's born from grief and rage. And so Sabrina Fulton is trying to reflect on what it means for Michael Brown's mother to join this group of women who are tethered together through loss. And in the letter, she talks about how this group of mothers is part of, in her words, an exclusive yet growing group of parents who've lost loved ones to senseless gun violence. And she talks about how if in our country people cannot hear Black pain, and particularly Black maternal pain, perhaps what we need to do is make them feel us.
And then Imani Perry in 2019 came out with a book called Breathe. What form did that book take?
Yeah, so Perry's book, as you said, comes out in 2019, and it's also a letter. It's a letter addressed to her two sons, Freeman and Issa. And so in 2019, she's writing in the heart of Black Lives Matter. If we can imagine a pre-pandemic time, it's a pre-pandemic moment. And she wants to imagine a world where her sons can survive, right? And so she calls the book Breathe. In part, we can imagine the book coming out in a world where I Can't Breathe had become a rallying cry for Black Lives Matter, a way of talking about state-sponsored, state-sanctioned violence against Black people generally and Black men and boys particularly. And so Perry writes as a mother who wants her Black boys to survive, and she wants to think about what it means for Black maternal life to be structured by an anxiety, an intense worry about a world that seems governed by a desire to kill Black people, to ensure that life is not livable for Black people. And so as you were saying in your question, the structure that she uses is this letter. So we as readers are, in a sense, eavesdropping on a letter that she writes her boys.
And this makes me think of Ta-Nehisi Coates' 2015 book, Between the World and Me, which is a letter to his 15-year-old son. Is this an analogous sort of situation where people are, as parents, talking to their children, writing to their children, but in a very public way?
I think you're exactly right. I think Coates' book is a kind of critical citation in this genealogy of Black letter writing. I think Coates' letter becomes a form that Black feminists during Black Lives Matter recruit and in a way take over and repurpose to foreground Black maternal labor, the Black maternal work of keeping children alive, the Black maternal work of worrying, of watching out, of preparing our children for how to survive and how to navigate a world that doesn't value Black life. And so part of what I'm interested in the chapter is what it means, going back to where we started with Sabrina Fulton, that the way that Black folks make pain knowable and make grief knowable is through strategically using this form of the letter, which allows us as a reader to feel like we're listening in on a private conversation that didn't anticipate us, right? We get to see how Perry is talking to her boys, or how Ta-Nehisi Coates is talking to his son. It's a device, right? It's a device that I think, as I argue in the book, takes off in popularity, proliferates during Black Lives Matter, when I think there is a new attention to the political life of Black grief.
Now, of course, Fulton or Perry could have written something other than a letter, right? Not use a letter form, simply expressed their emotions, their reactions, their opinions in just a more straightforward way. Are you then saying that there is something about the letter form that can have a different sort of, maybe even a more immediate sort of impact on a reader?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely it. To be clear, in the book, I'm really interested in the letter as a device, as a strategy that Black feminist writers in the Black Lives Matter era mobilize to make grief and pain visible. And I think it is a device and a strategy that is profoundly powerful because it allows readers to think that we're accessing something private, that we're accessing something intimate, that we're accessing something that didn't anticipate us, and that we're getting closer to the truth of something, right? So you're absolutely right that Sabrina Fulton could write a letter that says, you know, here are the names of Black people who were gunned down by the police, and here are the statistics on police violence. And that is to build a certain kind of case, right, about how anti-Black violence persists in this world. And I think it's also a case that hasn't proven effective in U.S. culture, right? It's a case that's been made again and again and is ignored. And so I think Black feminists have turned to a different strategy in this era, which is, what does it mean to speak about Black pain and grief in an intimate register? And so readers are confronted not with argumentation or statistics or data, but are positioned as eavesdroppers who get to hear something, which is about the felt life of grief, about the cost, the emotional and physical cost of racialized worry and anxiety, and about the duration of Black loss. And I think that case is made more persuasive, I would argue, by the form of the letter.
Is there any cost to that? I mean, there's something in the book that you write about that, you know, why should Black people and Black women have to bear their souls in this kind of way in order to get attention?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a tremendous cost to this performance, right? I think the costs are multiple. I think, one, there's not a lot of space for the feelings that can swirl around Black grief. In particular, I'm thinking about rage. And we might think of the paucity of cultural space for Black women to articulate anger. I'm thinking about when Philando Castile was murdered and his mother stood on the steps of the courthouse and yelled into a microphone and said something like, they're going to come for all of your children too. And she said, my son loved this state and this is what the state did to him. And you could feel not just her grief, but the intensity of her rage. And there was this sense, I think, that there was not space for her anger in the kind of canon of Black maternal writing and representation, because what is to be presented again and again is a kind of quiet grief. So I'm interested very much in the kind of feelings that can't be represented, but I'm also interested in the kind of grief economy that circulates around Black feminist writing, which I think, you know, if the book is interested in how certain forms and voices have come to be the dominant voices in Black feminist writing, it is certainly the case that Black grief has come to be written and represented in a certain set of ways, right? That when Black women, Black feminists write Black grief and Black loss, it is almost always about the murder of Black boys and men at the hands of the state. They're writing about forms of violence that are now expected, right? That we know this story, that they're anticipated. And so other forms of loss can't fit within the frame of Black loss that Black feminists are expected to mobilize when they talk about grief. And then I think there are the personal costs of having to make one's grief public. So there's a moment in the chapter when I talk about Tamir Rice's mother, Samaria Rice, who gave a really stunning interview to Imani Perry, where she said, I think the quote was that we need to stop hustling Black death. And she talked about how so many folks had taken up her son's story on all sides of the political spectrum, that there was this way in which his story was not hers anymore, that she had lost her son again in the sense that she had no control over how the story of his death was circulated and used. that in a certain kind of way, her grief on his loss had become a commodity. And what I thought was so powerful about her insistence that we stop hustling Black Death was that she was speaking as much to the right, which has always made a commodity of Black Death to sort of shore up narratives of Black pathology, as she was speaking to the left and Black Lives Matter, who had made Tamir Rice a symbol of state violence. And so I think she was pushing us to think about what that had cost her and her family, this sense that her son's story and his memory were not hers anymore.
That's Jennifer Nash. She is Jean Fox Obar Professor of Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies at Duke University. We are talking about her book, How We Write Now, Living with Black Feminist Theory. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Imani Perry wrote that Tamir Rice had become everyone's child. Talk about what she meant by that. And I also want to ask you about the notion, well, you write in your book that the notion of Black children as community property has been a key strategy advocated by Imani Perry and others.
Yeah, so I think the idea that Perry is thinking about, right, Tamir Rice as everyone's child, is in part this sense that Tamir Rice's murder is one that Black folks experience as something that could happen to anyone, right? And I think of the various ways this has been articulated, that moment when Obama was president and he said about Trayvon Martin that he experienced Martin's murder personally because Martin looked like him, right? The sense that this could have been me or it could have been my children. And so this idea of everyone's child is in part a sense that, particularly, I think, given the vocabulary that Black Lives Matter has generated for us, a mode of thinking about Black life and Black death, this sense that all Black children are vulnerable, are acutely vulnerable to state violence, and that all Black mothers are acutely vulnerable to the loss or theft of their children. And I think Black Lives Matter has helped us think about the theft of our children really capaciously, that it could be murder by the police, that it can be incarceration, that it can be racial profiling, that it can be a sense that our children are not allowed to be children, that they're policed or surveilled. This theft can take so many forms. And I think the idea of Black children as community property, which is a phrase that Carla Holloway, the Black feminist legal scholar, uses, has in part been a strategy that Black feminists and other kind of left thinkers and activists have mobilized to think that, you know, we have a responsibility to keep all our children safe. And I think about how Black feminists have always been at the vanguard of a conception of motherhood that is not necessarily biological. I think of Patricia Hill Collins's work on other mothering and community mothering, that when Black feminists talk about mothering, we talk about the responsibility we have for children writ large. We talk about auntie work and grandmother work and all the ways that so many of us who are not necessarily biological mothers feel a compulsion to keep all Black children safe, to keep an eye out, to keep a lookout, to put our bodies between our children and the world to ensure their safety. I think it's important always to note that conception of community property really hinges on women doing work, right? I think the idea of other mothering and community mothering is still an idea that children are the responsibility of women, that the work of mothering is women's work. And I think it's also important to remember that that work is always devalued, right? It's always seen as less than important.
What is the talk, in quotes, that Black parents have with their children, particularly their sons? And how is the letter similar to or different from the talk?
So I think the talk is something that became introduced to a broader public during Black Lives Matter as a shorthand for describing how Black parents prepare their children for surveillance and policing, prepare their children for the fact that they cannot do things that their white peers might be able to do without fear of punishment. And that punishment might take the form of violence. I think it's a way that parents talk to their children about how to deal with and navigate entanglements with law enforcement, right? That police will stop you. They will ask you questions, that this is how you engage with them. I also think the talk, and here I'm thinking about a colleague of mine, Mia Brantley at North Carolina State. She talks about how the talk often takes gendered forms, how the talk, when it's delivered to Black boys, is often about, again, like the threat of being policed or surveilled, how when it's directed at Black girls, it's often also about ensuring that Black girls present themselves in the world in ways that are sexually respectable, so that there's not a presumption of their sexual promiscuity or excessive sexuality. So all in all, the talk is about preparing children. Really, we're talking about children here, for an anti-Black world, and for the fact that children need to be prepared for the fact that they will be policed and surveilled and disciplined, and that they have to know from a very early age how to maneuver that, how to negotiate that, how to advocate for themselves, but also do it in a way that we hope will allow them to continue to be safe. And so I think the talk, to go back to a word I was using earlier, worry, which is too small of a word, I think, for getting at what Black parents, I think, feel when they deliver the talk. But I think the talk reveals the ways that anticipated violence marks Black parents' experiences of parenting. In other words, they're always preparing their children for something that they know will come, right? There will be a time when somebody in a store accuses you of shoplifting. There will be a time when a police officer asks you questions or asks to look in your bag. There will be a time when the homeowners association says that you're cutting across somebody's lawn in violation of the association's rule. These things will happen. And so I think there's a way that anticipation is fundamental to the logic of the talk. And I think to your question about the letter, I think the letter is a form. And I think it's a form of advocacy that has been used, I think, really successfully, that has been wielded during Black Lives Matter by Black authors and Black feminist authors in particular, to allow non-Black readers to see that talk unfold and to feel it, right? To go back to that word, to eavesdrop on it, to imagine what it is like to talk to your sons, in the case of Imani Perry's book, about the fact that their survival is not guaranteed. And I also think underpinning both the talk and the letter is a confession by Black mothers, which is, I cannot keep you safe. I want to, I wish I could guarantee your safety, but the ways that anti-Blackness and misogyny operate are such that I cannot guarantee your safety, which has been the condition of Black children in this country since its country's inception. And since I cannot guarantee your safety, I am going to give you this set of tools and techniques to help you navigate this world. So I'm really interested in the letter, as I said, as a form of advocacy work that Black feminists do to allow non-Black readers a glimpse into what it is like to have a conversation with your child about the fact that their innocence is never presumed.
That's the voice of Jennifer C. Nash. She teaches gender, sexuality, and feminist studies at Duke University. Her books include Birthing Black Mothers, Black Feminism Reimagined After Intersectionality, and The Black Body in Ecstasy. We are talking about her latest book, How We Write Now, Living with Black Feminist Theory. It's published by Duke University Press. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. So in early 2022, Joy Sewing, who is a columnist at the Houston Chronicle, published a letter to her four-year-old son. The piece was titled, A Letter to My Black Son About Trayvon Martin 10 Years Later. Now, if Sewing knows, and readers of the letter know, that her son is too young, right, 4 years old, to understand the contents of her letter, then what is Sewing using this piece of writing to do? What is her purpose in writing it?
Yeah, I think her purpose in writing it is twofold. I think one is to require readers to imagine what it is for a mother to sit face to face with her four-year-old son and to anticipate the violence that the world will inflict on him. And so I think in part, she's using the letter to require us as readers or as ethical readers to think about the horror of that scene, right? What does it mean to look at your small child and to think about all the violence that the world will inflict on him? So I think in part she wants us to think about anticipation as the logic that governs Black maternal life. And the second thing that I think she's trying to do in that piece is to think about how age is no protection from having to give your child the quote-unquote talk or to imagine the violence that the world will inflict on your child. In other words, that even if you imagine the smallness of a four-year-old and the innocence of a four-year-old, that even at that very young age, Black mothers are imagining what it would mean to lose that child, right? Or for that child to experience violence. And I think as a device, which is the word that I've used again and again, Sewing is rendering her son a kind of literary figure, because as she says in the letter, you're too young to understand this, right? You're too young to read this. You might see this one day when you're 10 or 11, but right now you can't imagine it. So he becomes, in a sense, a kind of character, right, in the letter that allows us as readers to understand a kind of logic that governs the contemporary life of Black mothers and their sons. And I also think part of what she's doing is writing in a tradition, right? So we've talked about Imani Perry, we've talked about Ta-Nehisi Coates, we've talked about Sabrina Fulton, we've talked about how again and again the letter has become this key form through which Black mothers talk about Black loss. It's, I think, the form through which a broad American public came to know Black loss during Black Lives Matter. And so she's adding her voice to the chorus that's taken over this form and used it for the political ends of revealing that Black maternal life is tethered to grief. And I think part of what she's showing is just how powerful a form it is.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Now, back to Against the Grain.
So this grief, this anticipation of loss, operates on the level of the everyday. And you make this very clear in your book that we're not talking about something spectacular or sensational. This is about talking with your child, perhaps over the kitchen table. This is about taking your child to Cub Scouts meetings or soccer games and worrying that something might happen. What interests you about that? That often Black people are presented as sort of symbols, symbols of what can happen in a racist society. And yet, on the level of kind of the quotidian, there is something that needs to be said about Black existence.
Yeah, so I'm really interested in the everyday, which I think is where this book was born. I think I'm interested in the everyday for a few reasons. I think to the larger point that we've been talking about around Black death and the ways in which anticipation structures so much of Black maternal life, I'm interested in the ways that Black death enters the kind of national imaginary and consciousness through the spectacular. So we, I think, as a country, at least in that brief moment in 2020, when it seemed like the world was changing around race, and I think part of what's so interesting is like here we are 4 years later and the world hasn't changed, right? But there was this moment 4 years ago when we came to know Black loss through the spectacular. We came to know it through George Floyd. We came to know it through Philando Castile. We came to know it through Trayvon Martin. Black loss came to be synonymous with dead or dying Black men or boys murdered by the state and usually followed by the non-indictment or acquittal of police officers. Like that was the script for Black loss. And I'm really interested both in the everydayness of how the anticipation of loss is lived. What does it feel like? To use the example that you gave, how are conversations about survival happening at the dinner table or in the car on the way to Girl Scouts or in conversations before bedtime, right? So that these conversations about Black death are folded into the ordinary even as Black Death is so often imagined as spectacular. But I'm also interested in the book, in the kinds of Black loss that get written out of the frame of Black loss that I think we Black feminists developed, right? Which is, as I said, a frame that's about the murder of Black men and boys at the hands of the state. And I think there was this moment, this really powerful moment, where the first intervention into the conversation about Black loss was an intervention by Kimberly Crenshaw and other Black feminists around Say Her Name. And it was an intervention that was like, Black women and girls and Black trans folks too are also murdered by the state, right? And so we have to attend to the ways in which those stories fall out of the narrative about Black death, because the frame of Black loss has prioritized Black male life. And that is an important intervention. And also, I'm curious about the forms of loss, of Black loss, that are not spectacular, that in the context of my book are slow, are endured, are quotidian, are embedded in daily life, that don't fall comfortably into the frame of Black loss. And so I think don't get talked about. And I think that's in part the conversation that the book wanted to stage.
And the book is How We Write Now by my guest Jennifer Nash. And in the chapter we are focusing on, which is about the letter form, the epistolary form, you bring up a book written by Julietta Singh in the form of an extended letter to her six-year-old daughter. So this book, The Breaks, came out in 2021. Here we're talking about a brown mother talking to her, writing to her brown daughter. What sorts of things and phenomena does Singh see looming in her daughter's future that could, she thinks will pose a threat to her daughter?
So Julietta Singh's The Breaks is interested in what it means for a brown girl to come of age in a time of catastrophe. She says very clearly that the catastrophes that she's interested in are not necessarily the catastrophes that Black men face, the catastrophe, the fear of being, in Singh's words, gunned down by police in the streets. But she is interested in another set of catastrophes. She's interested in the horrific effects of global capitalism. She's interested in ecological catastrophe, which has never been more visible than in the last few weeks. She's interested in the destruction of the planet. And she's interested in what it means for her daughter to come of age in a world where maybe for the first time, the idea that there is a future seems in question, right? When I think when we talk about catastrophe, we're talking about them in the plural and the fact that they intersect and seem overwhelming. And so she's writing a letter to think about what it means to mother her brown daughter in these times. And also, and I think part of why I'm interested in her work is because she's interested in the fact that for her daughter to survive, and maybe for the world to live on, she argues that her daughter will need to break with her mother, hence the title, The Breaks, that she will need to find ways of living and being that don't replicate the old ways. Because one thing Singh is sure of is that the ways that we have lived until now have led only to destruction. And so in some ways, the book is an invitation for her daughter to break and to find and imagine and dream different ways of being that might get us out of some of the binds that we find ourselves in. And so Singh is drawing on Saidiya Hartman's book, Lose Your Mother, but taking that term, Lose Your Mother, and inflecting it differently and saying to her daughter, we have to lose our mothers. We have to break from our mothers and make ourselves on our own. But the invitation that she offers her daughter in The Breaks is that she hopes her daughter breaks with her rather than from her, that they find ways of being and relating and connecting, even as her daughter forges, Singh hopes, other ways of being in the world.
Right, and one could see, Julietta Singh could see the break she is advocating, the break she thinks is necessary, She could see that as a form of loss. What do you think of that, and how is Tsang framing this break?
Yeah, so I think for Tsang, the break is definitely a form of loss, at least is a form of loss from the mother's position, right? So I think Tsang, going back to anticipation, imagines her daughter breaking from her at some point in the future and imagines that it will feel lonely, right? That it will feel potentially hurtful, that it will feel strange. I think for her, the breaks can't happen without loss. But I think she's interested in what it might mean to forge an ethical kind of loss, or a loss that is an opening to a different way of relating, a different way of being together. And so I keep returning to that phrase that she uses, where she invites her daughter to break with her rather than from her, so that Tsang as the mother is not someone who's left behind or discarded, but someone, a resource that her daughter can draw on in forging new ways of being. And so I think part of what Tsang is trying to do in her book is to use this form, right, the form of the letter that's been such a powerful tool for Black feminists to think about Black loss, and to use it to think about loss differently, to think about loss as something that might be necessary, that might be required for forms of relationality and for living on. I think she wants to think about loss not as spectacular, but as something that might unfold over the course of her daughter's life and over the course of her relationship with her daughter. I think she wants to think loss apart from catastrophe. And I think she wants to imagine herself, a brown mother interested and invested in Black feminist theory, not as a kind of icon of grief, but as someone who gets to continue to be together with her daughter in a struggle for a different kind of a world.
How important is that to you, to see loss as, and to have loss represented as, life-affirming in a sense, not necessarily threatening and overwhelming, or only threatening and overwhelming?
Well, I'm interested in the variety of ways that loss can feel. And I think part of the grief economy around Black life and Black death has been that Black loss means only one thing. So I think part of why I'm drawn to Tsang is because of her commitment to opening up loss, and particularly brown loss, and particularly an understanding of brown loss that draws on Black feminist work. Her interest in opening it up to be plural, to feel in many different ways. I think there's a moment somewhere in this book where I talk about the fact that loss can be of many different things and people, that sometimes it can feel like a world-ending moment, and sometimes it can feel like an opening and an invitation to something new. It can be both of those. It can be a site of ambivalence. And so I'm interested in drawing on this thing, because I think it's a resource for me for thinking about carving out a Black feminist conception of loss in the plural that gives, I hope, space for a greater range of representations of the complexity of Black affect and feeling.
Now, this issue of loss is very personal to you. The preface to your book delves into your relationship with and perception of your mother, who has Alzheimer's. You write, "I bring to this project, this book project, a dense set of desires for my mother to live on in a form that is familiar to me." How does this inform or otherwise relate to what you've been saying about the epistolary form, about grief and intimacy and eavesdropping?
So, you know, as you mentioned, the book starts in a deeply personal voice that I think throughout how we write now, I'm interested in both diagnosing that voice and using it. And I think part of what I'm interested in is the power that a certain kind of intimate voice has in this moment, as we've been talking about in the letter form, and I think in other forms of Black feminist writing that have become entrenched as forms, that have become visible as forms. So I'm interested in laying claim to that voice, and I'm also interested in thinking about what that voice can obscure. As you said, I start the book with an interest in personal loss. I start the book by writing about my mother and thinking with Alzheimer's as a form of cruel loss that I think is cruel because it's slow. And I think many people who live with or care for people who have Alzheimer's talk about the duration of it, and the fact that someone you love slowly and then quickly becomes someone you don't know anymore is a particularly, I think, cruel and unbearable form of loss. And part of what I wanted to think about in this book was that I've spent most of my thinking life immersed in a field, Black feminist theory, that has given me so many tools and grammar to write and think about loss, but I couldn't find a grammar for thinking about my mother in the Black feminist tradition that I'm trained in. And so I wanted to think about what it might mean to make space in our thinking about Black loss for someone like my mother, where my loss is not spectacular, it's ordinary, it's deeply ordinary. It's so ordinary that one of the things that I've experienced with having written this book is how many people talk to me about their own experiences of their mothers and fathers and grandparents with Alzheimer's. It's a deeply ordinary experience, and it's a formulaic experience. Most people who caregive someone who has Alzheimer's describe the same challenges. But I also wanted to think about the aspects of this loss that felt deeply to me like Black loss. And so I wanted to push on the frame that I've been talking about with you of Black loss that I think can't yet attend to the ordinariness of Black loss that unfolds quietly and slowly, like the one that I've been dealing with.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My guest is Jennifer Nash. She is the Jean Fox O'Barr Professor of Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies at Duke University. We are talking about her latest book, How We Write Now, Living with Black Feminist Theory. We have a link to Jen's faculty page at Duke, as well as to the book on our website, againstthegrain.org. So it's one thing to write in the epistolary form. It's another thing to write in a compelling way, right? If you're going to try and make your thoughts and anxieties and worries and considerations available to a mass audience, you want to write in a way that will draw people in. And I think this relates to something you write about in the first chapter of your book, which is beauty, writing in a beautiful voice. Can you talk about what beauty's role might be or ought to be in relation to the writing of Black feminists and Black mothers?
Sure. So in many ways, this book started with my interest in reading the work of contemporary Black feminist writers, some of whom are academic, some of whom aren't. And I think there's been this interesting moment in Black feminist writing where that boundary between academic and non-academic has become more permeable, where there's been a tremendous appetite for Black feminist popular writing in the form of trade books. So there's a lot of people kind of traversing that boundary more than ever. I was interested in how the voice of the writers in this field that I call home felt to me like it had changed substantially. And I'm thinking about writers like Imani Perry, who we've talked about, like Christina Sharp, who's the author of Ordinary Notes and In the Wake, like Elizabeth Alexander, who wrote The Trayvon Generation, Natasha Trethewey, who wrote Memorial Drive, among others. I wanted to think about how they were doing the work of Black feminist theory differently, and how part of what was different was the voice in which they were writing. Oh, and Saidiya Hartman, who I didn't mention, but who's crucial. And so part of what I wanted to think about was how across this interdisciplinary body of academic and non-academic work, there was the consistency of a voice that I think aspires to create an intimacy with its readers, that I think aspires, I think the phrase I use in the book is to whisper in our ears, to create an immediate closeness between the author and the reader. I think it's a voice that is singular in its attention to detail, in its willingness to linger in detail, in its commitment to a form of writing that's almost poetic or literary. I think it's a voice that wants to move us. And one of the things that I say in the book is the voice may not move every reader, but I think it is a voice that is persuasive enough that if you are not moved, it's on you to stop and ask, why doesn't this move me? Why am I unmoved by this? And I think it's a voice that is fundamentally preoccupied with loss and that thinks about loss by suggesting that we need to get as close to it as possible, that the way that we do justice to loss is by providing it with companionship, and the way that we provide it with companionship is by attending to its details. And so I wanted to think about all of those characteristics as collectively producing a voice that I describe as beautiful. And I think part of what I'm trying to do is use beauty not as a form of valuing the work, like, oh, what a beautiful sweater, or what a beautiful day, but as a way of thinking about its almost literary voice as a mode of sitting with loss. This is it feels to me like a very different way of sitting with loss than treating loss with abstract distance or purported objectivity, or even a mode of dealing with loss that suggests that the way that we deal with it is to get as far away from it as we can. And so in the book, I'm interested in thinking about beauty as a voice, as a mode of thinking with loss that has become dominant, that has become popular, that has become expected in how Black feminists write now in this moment. And it's a voice that I try to take on in the book. And it's a voice where I also want to think about what it makes possible and also what it makes impossible.
I feel like I was talking to somebody many moons ago who was saying that he admired people who were sort of trying to do the impossible. They were trying to express things that really couldn't be expressed. And he found that okay, and in fact, kind of admirable. And even though that writer could not clearly depict something, the effort made to depict that something was moving and meaningful to him, the reader. And I wonder if you feel that way about people writing about, again, loss which cannot be expressed, which cannot be fully expressed. Do you find something important about that and moving about that and maybe even heroic about that?
Yeah, I'm deeply, deeply moved by the work that I write about in this book. I'm moved by a Black feminist insistence that writing should be personal. At some point in this book, I quote Patricia Williams, who says something like, "What is impersonal writing but a denial of the self?" And I see here in the archive that I've assembled in this book a Black feminist desire to, in Elizabeth Alexander's words, stay at the bone. I admire that deeply. I also sense in this archive, thinking again with Elizabeth Alexander, that there is a Black feminist sensibility that one of the ways that we honor those who we have lost is by staying with them. So I think about a moment, and this is actually an interview Elizabeth Alexander gave after her husband died, after she'd published her book. She said something like she was afraid to stop writing because she felt like as long as she was writing Light of the World, she was with her husband. And she saw the act of writing as a way of returning to him every day. I am so moved by that, right? I mean, how could you not be moved by that? So I think to your question of course there is the ways in which grief and loss escape our capacity to name them. And also, I move by the effort to transport readers to the scene of loss. I think that's admirable is not the right word. I think it's important. I think it's ethical work, and I think it's staged a really crucial intervention in Black feminism inside and outside of the academy as of late. I think, like any effort ever, there are always shortcomings. And so as I say in the book, I'm really interested in how we can offer accounts of Black loss that center the ordinary, that sit with the ordinary, because I think one of the primary ways that anti-Blackness operates is to deny Black people ordinariness, to insist that we are always spectacular signs and symbols of something, whether it's of deviance or pathology or et cetera, et cetera. And so I'm really interested in what it might mean for us to reclaim the ordinary as a site of Black life and living and Black complexity. But in saying that the writing that I talk about can't attend to everything, how could it? Nothing can. So all this to say, I am, of course, deeply moved by the work. And I think, you know, the subtitle of my book is Living with Black Feminist Theory. And these are texts that I've lived with. And I mean that quite seriously. I think for so many of us who work in Black feminist theory, the work isn't just work. It's a set of texts that we travel with and return to, that guide us in certain moments, that help us think through the complexities of everyday life. And certainly the texts that I write about in this book, which are all about loss, have helped me think about how to live with and live through loss.
We've focused on one and a little bit more chapter of this book, How We Write Now. What else is addressed in this book?
Yeah, so thanks for that. I think I try to think about other forms that Black feminist beautiful writing takes on. I have a lengthy rumination on how Black feminist writing is no longer just writing. I think a lot about how Black feminist texts include photography and are quite interested in the inclusion of images, particularly images of family members. So I have a chapter that thinks through that. And I think a lot about the memoir and its call to stay at the bone, Elizabeth Alexander's quote, and what it means when Black feminist texts do memoiristic work. And of course, as we've talked about, the book is not just bookended, I think it's threaded throughout the book, but it's also in many ways a kind of story of my own parents and trying to think through what it means to lose my mother slowly. And I think in many ways trying to think through a question that maybe underpins all engagement with loss, which is, where did this story start? And so in many ways, the book is me asking where a Black feminist account of loss should begin, as I think about my mother and where I would start to tell the story of her diagnosis with Alzheimer's. And so much of the book is me writing about my parents and their long, very long marriage, and my own memories of my mother and her mother, who also had Alzheimer's, trying to think about the long history of my family's entanglement with this cruel illness. So in some ways, the book is an experiment with, is my own experiment in memoir writing.
And briefly, what is Staying at the Bone?
Staying at the Bone is a term that Elizabeth Alexander uses in Light of the World for being as close as you can to the thing itself. So the quote that she writes is, if you can stay at the bone of what's true, then that's your lifeboat. And so I'm really moved by this idea of staying at the bone, which is, I think, to move inwards, to move close, and to stay there, to linger there, to refuse to, in the language of the camera, zoom out. I'm really interested in this idea of staying at the bone as a kind of touchstone of Black feminist writing.
Jennifer Nash, professor of gender, sexuality, and feminist studies at Duke University. We've been talking about her latest book. It is How We Write Now, Living with Black Feminist Theory, published by Duke University Press. Jen, thanks very much for writing this book and for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You just heard C.S. Song from Against the Grain in conversation with Jennifer C. Nash. This segment originally aired on KPFA Radio on October 16, 2024. I'm Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Join us again next Monday morning for more news, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. I'm leaving you with some music by Charles Mingus, a tune called Goodbye, Pork Pie Hat. Thanks so much for listening.